Okay, thanks a lot. So in this talk, I'm going to try to do two things. One is to give sort of an overview of entanglement entropy in various systems and some recent calculations. And secondly, to describe three hints that entanglement entropy is related in a deep and important way to geometry, especially in the context of ADS-CFT. So I'll start with some qualitative but probably important thoughts about geometry and entanglement. This is basically an overview of well-known recent ideas on this, at least well-known in certain circles, and then I'll move on to a couple of concrete calculations relating, calculating entanglement entropy and relating it to geometry. So entanglement entropy is defined whenever we can separate a Hilbert space into two factors, HA and HB. The case that I'll always be talking about is geometric entanglement entropy. So in a local theory, a thing that makes a lot of sense is to separate it into regions and associate a Hilbert space to each region. The reduced density matrix on region A is defined by tracing out the degrees of freedom in region B. In general, that's going to create a mixed state in region A, and the entanglement entropy is just the resulting entropy of that mixed state. So a simple example is thermal entropy. If A is our system, B is our bath, and these things are in equilibrium, then the entanglement entropy, the entropy of region A, will be the ordinary thermodynamic entropy. Another simple example that I want to use to set some cartoon notation here is the example of two spins. If we have two spins, call them S1 and S2, and denote them by these green lines, then a pure state is a wave function that's a 2x2 matrix that I'll call A and denote by this blue dot. The maximally entangled state of two spins is the Bell pair. The Bell pair has entanglement entropy log 2, so this is sort of the basic unit of entanglement entropy for these spins. The idea that I want to get across in the first part of this talk is that entanglement entropy encodes the organization of quantum information in the state of a system. So the example that I'll talk about is spins in one spatial dimension. So let's take so this is discrete, obviously. We'll take k spins denoted by these little green lines. If we take a completely general state of k spins, say we pick a random state, then the wave function is given by a rank k tensor A. So it's specified by 2 to the k complex numbers. This is an enormous Hilbert space. If we separate off some subsystem of L spins, then in a random state, this is just going to be maximally entangled with the rest of the system. And the entanglement entropy we'll get for this region size L is proportional to L. So this is called the volume law, and this is typically what happens in sort of random, mixed up, maximally entangled states. So usually we're not, or often we're not interested in random states. We're interested in states like ground states, states with local correlations. So ground states of a local Hamiltonian are very special, occupying only a tiny corner of this enormous Hilbert space. For a gapped Hamiltonian in one dimension, there should be no long distance correlations in the ground state. And what that means is that the entanglement entropy is a constant. It comes only from the area piece, which in one dimension is just a constant. So it's only coming from correlations across the boundaries of your region. So what this implies, right, okay, so the entanglement entropy goes as a constant, and this implies something very useful about the wave function in the ground state. What it implies is that we don't need 2 to the k complex numbers to represent this ground state wave function. We need some much smaller set of data. We can represent the wave function locally as a product of matrices. So what this picture means is that we have our green things are the spins. Each blue dot is a p by p matrix. We attach a matrix to each spin and multiply them all together. So whereas this random state had 2 to the k complex numbers, the ground state of a local gapped Hamiltonian is parameterized by p squared complex numbers. It does not grow exponentially with the size of the system.
This error is something can be proven. You can prove this based on some simple property like translation invariance and the gap, or?
I think that's true for a gapped Hamiltonian in one space dimension, yes. So to see if this is a good representation of the ground state wave function, we can estimate how much entanglement such a wave function can encode.
Sorry, I missed the definition of p.
P is a number that we get to choose, which is an internal, there's some internal indices denoted by blue lines, the internal indices on the matrices. And what I'm about to do is choose p big enough to encode the entanglement in this state. It's something that we get to pick. But the point is that it doesn't grow with the size of the system.
But you're assuming that L is bigger than the size of the gap.
That's right. So to see if this is a good way of writing down the wave function, we can estimate how much entanglement can this wave function encode. Well, if we try to separate out some subsystem, region A here, then it's easy to convince yourself that the maximal entanglement entropy that this can encode is sort of the number of dangling indices if you cut this piece of the wave function out of the rest of the system. In this case, we have p by p matrices, and it's straightforward to see that the entanglement entropy is bounded above by log p. So in a system where the entanglement entropy is just a constant, independent of the size of the region, picking some constant number p here is an efficient way of representing the wave function. So we don't need an exponentially large amount of data to specify this ground state wave function. This fact underlies the success of numerical calculations in 1D systems with a gap. It's the fact that you can efficiently represent the wave function in terms of these matrix product states. At a critical point, we do have long distance correlations, so the story here is a little different. At a critical point, I'll come back to this formula later, but the entanglement entropy grows as log of the size of the system. This suggests an efficient tensor network representation as a tree. So the meaning of this tree is that each blue dot is a tensor with some internal indices that we can specify. And the blue lines specify how these tensors are contracted together. So instead of taking one giant exponentially large rank k tensor to specify this ground state wave function, we can take these smaller tensors and multiply them together in this way, denoted by the tree. So again, to ask if this is a good way of writing the wave function, we should ask how much entanglement this tree can encode. To do that, we pick some subsystem, and we cut it out from the rest of the system and ask how many dangling indices there are. So we should cut the minimal number of links on this tree. The minimal number of links that you can cut for a system of size L on a tree is just the distance on the tree. Distances on trees go like logs. So the maximal amount of entanglement that a tree like this can encode grows as log L, which is the same as the growth in entanglement entropy of the 1D system at a critical point. So these pictures are, I'm being sort of schematic in my pictures, but they're called tensor tree networks, or MERA, depending on exactly how you define them. And all of this has at least a qualitative connection to holography. The entanglement entropy in a holographic CFT can be computed by the Ruta-Kinagi formula. So Ruta-Kinagi conjectured the following. We take our spatial slice of our CFT with a region A and a region B. We draw our holographic radial direction, and the entanglement entropy of region A is given by the area of a minimal surface that extends out into the bulk. This is now an extra-dimensional minimal surface, and the conjecture for the entanglement entropy is that SA is the area of the minimal surface over 4G newton. So this is a generalization of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy for black holes, as you can see from this area over 4G, which is not restricted to black hole horizons. It's something that applies much more generally to other types of surfaces, including Ringler horizons, which I'll come back to later. So this was conjectured by Ryu and Takinagi a while ago, and more or less proved under certain assumptions last year by Lukowitz and Nagasane. The relation to these tree networks, which was first pointed out by Swingle, is that cutting the tensor network to compute the entanglement entropy in a wave function like this very closely resembles this procedure I just described of drawing minimal area surface in anti-de Sitter space. The geometry of a tree is a discretized version of the geometry of hyperbolic space. And when we estimate the entanglement entropy by cutting the minimal number of links, you could think of that as a discretized version of computing the Ryu-Takinagi formula by drawing a minimal area surface extending into hyperbolic space. This relation between MARA and ADS-CFT is qualitative. Obviously, it's qualitative. This isn't even continuous. It's for a discrete spin system. There are attempts to make it continuous, but at this point, it's still a qualitative relationship between bulk and wave functions. We can think of each tensor as sort of being ADS radius size. There's no local information. We shouldn't expect to get local information at sub-ADS size from these tensors on the tensor tree. So what this does is it provides essentially another perspective on the statement that the radial direction is RG flow, because each layer that we go up in the tree here is sort of a coarse graining in real space of the layers below.
So again, what is the link on the tree? On the whatever.
So this this is a wave function, and each dot is a tensor. Say this dot here is a tensor with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 indices, and it's contracted to some other tensor according to the blue line.
What was the reason for the statement that the tree gave hyperbolic metric? In general, I would expect a tree to be in space or
right, so that comes from the fact that it's not just a tree. I've also interconnected at each level all of the links here, which makes it more like a discretization of hyperbolic space. If I had literally drawn a tree, then this point would be very far away from this point, and that would be an ultrametric space. Okay, so this is qualitative, but it suggests that entanglement entropy plays a fundamental role in understanding how the bulk geometry emerges. The rough picture is that spatial slices in ADS, at least the statement that's true, I think, is that spatial slices in ADS encode the organization of quantum information in a similar way to tensor networks. That statement is true. Whether we can make it more quantitative remains to be seen. So.
Just to be clear, so really given what you said, meaning the coarse grain or geometry on scales within the ADS range.
The hope is that we can do better than that, but yes, at this point, yes.
At least, yeah. You mentioned that each tensor of ADS radius size,
yes.
So obviously,
right. Right. I haven't used large N, strong coupling, and so on, so yes.
Now you have reduced strong coupling and large N in the right-hand side for the triangle.
Right. That's why this is a vague relationship. Yes. I'll just make one more point before I get on to more concrete things. which is the ER equals EPR relation. So suppose we start in the ground state of one of these critical systems, and then we excite some additional degrees of freedom and put them in an EPR pair. So we add some excitations here, which are far away, but maximally entangled. Well, this tensor network, the tree network that I drew, is no longer a good representation of this type of entanglement. It cannot encode long-distance entanglement between pairs like this. So the natural thing to do to try to represent this state is to add a tensor, draw this new line here, and the so there's a proposal of Malisane and Suskind from last year that we should think of entanglement as sort of a quantum wormhole. And I think this is one way of stating the intuition behind the state. It's that if we take seriously this picture that the structure of entanglement represents some space-time, then adding additional entanglement at long distance necessarily requires us to add these so-called wormholes.
But how do you gauge the distance?
At this point, you don't. Yeah.
When you say you put them in this EPR state, you mean you project ground state onto this internal state of affairs? What do you mean?
I just mean that we add a couple of particles on top of the ground state and we entangle them.
But they're correlated with the rest of this, they're entangled with the rest of the system.
Right.
Which is somehow still in its ground state.
Right, right.
I think you're doing a projector on the ground state, aren't you?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine what this spec really is. Write down this spec. Right, you have the ground state, and then you say, I add some extra spin.
Right, it's a two-particle state on top of the ground state.
These are excitations on top.
On top of the ground state.
So they're not eigenstates, they have alternative properties in general.
Right. Yeah, I don't, all of this, again, ER equals EPR is also qualitative. It's this qualitative to the same extent. All of this is
right. I didn't quite understand what you meant.
Okay.
Right. This structure, you may have links between the successive layers. Where did that come from?
It's an ansatz. We think of this as a variational ansatz for the wave function, and the point is that this ansatz. is a good ansatz to capture the ground state for a critical Hamiltonian. Okay, so let me move to something more concrete, which is calculations of entanglement entropy in two-dimensional conformal field theory. I'm not going to come back to these tensor networks. My point of presenting them was because I think that they are useful guide to the intuition of where geometry is supposed to be coming from, but they're not quantitative at this point. So okay, so calculations in two-dimensional conformal field theory. So we're in 1+1 dimensions, space is a line. So region A consists of one or more intervals, possibly disjoint. The method that we're going to use to calculate entanglement entropy is the replica trick. So we want to compute this von Neumann entropy minus trace of rho log rho. The log of an operator is something that's difficult to compute. So what's often done is to instead compute first the Reni or replica partition function. The replica partition function is a trace of rho I to the n. If we can compute this for integer n greater than 1, and are able to analytically continue back to n equals 1, then we can extract the entanglement entropy from this formula. So this is the intermediate step in the calculation of the entanglement entropy. And it's useful because there are no logs. It's useful because this replica partition function Zn in various states of interest, including the ground state, can be computed by a Euclidean path integral. These partition functions can be computed analytically in conformal field theory in at least four cases, four that I can think of. One is the case that A is a connected region, so just a single interval. If region A is just a single interval, then the answer is completely fixed by conformal invariance. I'll come back to why later, but this is universal. L here is the size of the region. Epsilon is the UV cutoff. C is the central charge of the CFT. The answer is completely fixed by symmetry. For our purposes, understanding where geometry is coming from, understanding how quantum information is organized in the ground state, this is a bit too universal. So you get the same answer whether you consider 1,000 free bosons or string theory on ADS3, which is dual to some CFT. So this is a very blunt probe of the difference between theories. It only depends on the central charge. The next thing we can do in two-dimensional CFT is to consider multiple intervals. Multiple intervals are not, the answer is not fixed by conformal invariance. It's going to be different in different theories. There are three cases that I know of where this can be, three methods to calculate this. It can be calculated in free field theory. It can be calculated in a small interval expansion, and it can be calculated in a limit of large central charge. So, so how are these replica partition functions calculated? I'm going to draw an example where region A is two disjoint intervals. And we work
out. When you say large central charge limit, presumably there's some additional assumption involved. Otherwise, you know, I'll just take that.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. I'll come back. Yeah. Okay. So to give a picture of what these partition functions are like, I'm going to consider this example where we have two slits. Region A is two disjoint segments, and we want to compute at replica number 3. So trace of rho A cubed for two slits. Rho A in the vacuum state for two slits can be represented by a Euclidean path integral. So this, what this picture means is a Euclidean path integral with some cuts on region A. If we were to put some boundary conditions on these cuts, then we would compute matrix elements of rho A. To calculate trace of rho A cubed, we just line up three of these guys next to each other, multiplying the density matrix together means gluing the cuts. So we glue the bottom of these cuts to the top of these. We glue the bottom of these to the top of those. And the trace instructs us to glue all the way back around from the bottom here to the top over there. So what I mean by this picture is this is just a two-dimensional surface, which is a multi-sheeted cover of the complex plane. Well, it's a two-dimensional surface, so it's a Riemann surface with possibly some non-trivial topology. This example, if you were to try to find the various cycles and trace your pen around on this figure for a few minutes, you can convince yourself that this example with two slits and three replicas has genus 2. Okay, so this picture here is really a picture like this. So the goal in computing these multiple interval replica partition functions and entanglement entropies is to compute CFT partition functions on higher genus surfaces. In the case that we have more than two slits or more than three replicas, this will go to even higher genus. So we have to be able to do this at arbitrary genus.
So do you work at some fixed complex moduli, or what's a complex moduli dependence?
It's fixed by the shapes of the region. Yeah. So it's a particular it's a particular slice in moduli space that only has one number parameterizing it. So when can we actually calculate these partition functions? So they've been calculated in free field theory. They can be evaluated exactly for the free fermion, the compact boson. The answer is actually for the, so there's a nice answer for the compact boson, for the replica partition function. But actually, I think the analytic continuation to n equals 1 that you would need for the entanglement entropy is not known in general. So it can be calculated in various expansions. But this is a complicated formula with some theta functions in it, and it's not known how to take the analytic continuation. In interacting field theory, there's two ways of calculating this analytically. There's a small interval expansion, and there's a large C expansion. And they both start off the same way. The starting point is that this replica partition function, instead of thinking of it as a partition function on some higher genus surface, it can be viewed as a correlation function of twist operators on a single copy of the complex plane. These twist operators are operators that glue the different sheets together. So instead of thinking of it as this higher genus surface, we can think of it as a four-point, in the case of two slits, so we insert an operator at the end of each slit. So for two slits, it's a four-point function. A good reason to organize it this way is that we have good intuition for how conformal invariance restricts correlation functions. Two-point functions are completely fixed by conformal invariance. So this is one way of saying why we get this simple universal answer, C over 3 log L, for a single slit. Anything higher than 2 points is not fixed by conformal invariance. It's going to depend on the operator content of the theory. But it is strongly constrained by conformal invariance. It has to have this form. So the four-point function the four-point function has to be expanded in conformal blocks where you sum over states in the intermediate channel. What this diagram means is that we sum over states, delta, OP coefficients times Virasoro conformal blocks. The conformal blocks depend on the dimension of the internal operator, the dimension of the external operator, which in this case is the twist operator, and the relative positions of the points. These Virasoro conformal blocks are just functions of Z that don't depend on the theory. They're completely fixed by the algebra and can be calculated using the Virasoro algebra. So the only thing in this formula that depends on the theory is which states we sum over and the OPE coefficients here. Like I said, there are two ways to proceed. You can expand in Z. Z is the size of the interval. So what I've done is I've used conformal symmetry to place the points at 0, Z, 1, and infinity, as you can do in a four-point function. Then Z is the size of this interval, and you can expand in Z and calculate the corrections to the entanglement entropy systematically in this expansion. The other thing you can do, which I'm going to describe in a little bit of detail, is an expansion in the central charge, expansion in 1 over the central charge. This can be done if we also assume that there's a small number of low-dimension operators. So this is a field theory assumption, large central charge, small number of low-dimension operators. But it's chosen so that these are theories that could plausibly have a holographic dual. Theories with a semi-classical holographic dual have to have large C, because in holographic CFTs, C is the ADS radius measured in Planck units. This
is like quasi-primary operators.
I didn't define small, so it doesn't matter.
But can you define small and low dimensions?
It can't grow exponentially in C, and actually, it doesn't matter whether I say this about primaries or quasi-primaries; it's the same. Okay, so in holographic CFTs, C is very large. But I'm not using ADS CFT here. This is just a CFT calculation. And the goal is to get some geometric information out directly from a CFT calculation in this regime.
Like a hydrogen growth is not allowed here?
So that will happen at high, those are not low dimension operators. So
let's say the
symmetric product is, yes. The symmetric overfold is allowed. But the n copies of the free boson is not. Okay. So a quick outline of this large C calculation. The key step is the fact that Virasoro conformal blocks have a nice form at large central charge. So this is a formula written down by Zamolodnikov a long time ago. The Virasoro block at large C exponentiates. So big F is the Virasoro block. At large C, it exponentiates into something that we'll call little f, or the semi-classical conformal block, people call it. We're doing a sum now over these exponentials in the OPE expansion. And when you do a sum over exponentials, you can evaluate the answer in a saddle point approximation. So we can evaluate this OPE expansion to leading order in 1 over C. It's going to be dominated either by a saddle point or by an endpoint of the sum. In this case, it's dominated by an endpoint, which is the vacuum state. So the fact that there's a 0 here is saying that this replica partition function is just the contribution from the Virasoro vacuum block.
Is that uniform in C, that approximation?
This one?
Yeah, either of them. I mean, are you making some assumptions about the cross ratio?
The cross ratio, yes.
Is it the cross ratio?
Oh, you said in Z.
Z, yeah.
Yeah, Z is fixed in this expansion.
But it's not close to 1. Well, I can't remember what your definition of Z was. Small intervals means Z near 0.
Yeah.
So is it Z less than something?
Z less than something. This is for any fixed Z. Z is fixed in the large
set. Yeah, but the errors are not bounded uniformly in C.
I think right. That's true. Okay. So this contribution is universal. It's independent of the details of the CFT. It's just the Virasoro vacuum block. It's not the same in every CFT because we use some assumptions about the field theory. We assume it was large C, and this is valid at leading order in 1 over C, but to all orders in the OPE expansion. That doesn't mean it's valid for all Z, because there could be non-perturbative there can be and are non-perturbative contributions, but it's valid to all orders in expansion in Z. We also assume that well operator multiplicities from the fact that this was dominated at the endpoint. So this is the, as I said, this replica partition function is the Virasoro block for the vacuum representation. So what it's saying is that this correlation function is dominated by the exchange of the stress tensor and things that you can build out of the stress tensor. So the stress tensor lives in the vacuum block. I guess I should say that if we were in higher dimensions, things would be very different. Different things you build out of the stress tensor live in different conformal blocks. So it's very important that we're using the Virasoro algebra. We're in two dimensions. So everything you can build out of the stress tensor lives in the same representation.
You said that you're using the approximation that delta is less than C, right? So you're approximating delta over C by 0.
Yeah, that's right. So
but they could still be operators which have finite delta.
Yeah, that's right. So when I say that it's dominated by the vacuum, what I mean is we can get the full answer from the vacuum.
Yeah.
This formula.
Still including the effect of these low dimensional
operators.
They just give something which is proportional.
they give a prefactor here,
yeah.
which doesn't contribute to the leading C dependence.
Yeah.
So we're including all of the contribution from the low dimension operators, but it's the only thing that matters is the vacuum block for calculating the leading exponential dependence at large C. So heavy correlators are exponentially dominated by the exchange of the stress tensor. I won't go too much into the holographic duality of this, but the dual statement is that these geometries are things that you can, is that these correlation functions are dominated by just by geometry, by the 3D graviton.
So from the point of view of the holographic view, it sounds like you're saying the leading answer is independent of alpha prime correlations. Is that the artifact of HS3?
Yes. I assume. Yeah.
While you cannot add any non-trivial local terms in the effective action involved, you're basically saying that sort of there's no room for non-local kind of corrections to affect the addition of the planning. That's probably true.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Okay, so there's this universal answer given by the Virasoro block. I'm not going to really go into how F is computed, but let me just say that Zamolodnikov computed it in Louisville from a null decoupling, a null state decoupling equation. It can be computed. In general, this computation, Zamolodnikov, has to be solved numerically, but in the limit of n to 1, relevant for the entanglement entropy, the computation can be done analytically. It's everything becomes easy, and so for the calculation of entanglement entropy, we can just do it all analytically. The answer, if we expand an S-channel OPE, is C over 3 times the log of this length plus C over 3 times the log of this length. So things just factorize.
When n goes to 1, hn goes to 0?
That's right.
So then hn is an order of limits.
There's an order of limits.
You say that hn is the order of C.
So
it's
there's...
for the previous computation to be correct.
Right. The correct order is to first calculate it as if it were a heavy operator, and then continue it to 0. So we should still treat it as if it were a heavy operator. So if we calculate the same thing in a T-channel expansion, then the answer is C over 3 times the log of the long thing plus C over 3 times the log of this. And the red lines that I've drawn on here are the Ruta-Kanagi surfaces, as if the vertical direction is the emergent holographic direction. So these lengths in hyperbolic space are logs. So the answer you get from this large C calculation is exactly the same answer you get from Ruta-Kanagi. It's an OPE expansion, so there's an extra assumption going in here that there are no other non-perturbative contributions besides the T-channel and the S-channel OPE, which so far there's no proof of the state. So that's the entanglement entropy in these large C theories. The replica partition function also agrees with ADS-CFT. Actually, it agrees in a nice way. So I'm not gonna go into too many details, but basically when you solve this Louisville-related equation that appears in Zamolodnikov's construction of the Kolmogorov block, what you're really doing is constructing a 3D geometry, satisfying the Einstein equation. So it's really a very direct map from trying to do CFT calculations in this regime forces you to construct 3D geometries. And that's not assuming ADS-CFT, that's just how Zamolodnikov taught us to compute these correlation functions. The quick explanation is that the way this F is computed is by constructing a particular SL2C connection on your Riemann surface. 3D gravity is classically equivalent to SL2C Chern-Simons. Zamolodnikov's SL2C connection is a three-dimensional smooth, a smooth three-dimensional geometry.
But would the lesson be that I have to take configurations with G equals zero or no? With the metric
what is
zero?
G? No. No, we don't.
You tell me it's like Chern-Simons gate theory. I have to take this configuration. So what's the lesson?
Right, right. So this is a classical, this is just a classical statement. This is a classical statement that is just about this particular solution, this particular SL2C connection that Sam Logicoff constructs. It's true, there are SL2C connections that correspond to degenerate metrics. But the particular one that Sam Logicoff constructs is not. It's a nice, smooth metric. So that's the only one that we need to care about for this statement. It's just classic.
And remind me how the counting works. 3D gravity in ADS has two Chern-Simons connections, but they're both SL2C?
Well, it depends whether we're Euclidean or so on, but in Euclidean, for this context, we're in Euclidean signature, and there's one complex SL2C connection.
Okay, so this is a complex SL2C connection in both cases.
Yeah. Well, there's sort of one for, there's two blocks here. There's the holomorphic block and the momentum holomorphic
right,
block.
They match up.
When you put them together, it's the two connections. Specifically, the statement is that if you're calculating on this replica manifold, you need to calculate some Virasoro vacuum block. And the Virasoro vacuum block that you need to calculate, it turns out, is exactly equal to the Einstein action on the manifold that you would get if you took this Riemann surface and filled it in. So this is a two-manifold, and this is a filled-in. So this is a three-manifold. The vacuum block on here is the Einstein action on here.
Is that true for all choices of spin structures?
That's a very good question. Choices of spin structures is related to which cycles you decide to fill in. And there are choices here. You can fill in this cycle and get the thing that I've drawn. Or you can fill in sort of the outside and get something else. And that corresponds to different OPE channel expansions. So there are different answers that you can get based on those choices. And each choice you make here corresponds to a different 3D geometry.
So the correct statement is, of course, the filling in is not unique. But really what you're saying is it's a theorem that the filling in that gives you the smallest action is the one that gives you a good approximation to the vacuum block. Is that right?
Well, it's not quite a theorem that it's always always the smallest. So to all orders in an expansion around small cycles, what you said is true. We can't prove that there are no other geometries that we haven't thought of that contribute non-perturbatively. Not every manifold can be constructed by taking this Riemann surface and filling in cycles. We don't really know how to deal with those other possible manifolds.
What about the effects of what you call the matter, which is the other operators, the finite dimension operators?
Yeah, so those...
Is there geometric interpretation to the contribution of those?
I don't know. That would be nice. So those will be, say, 1 over C corrections to this, which I would love to understand that a bit. Okay, so I've described two hints that entanglement entropy is an important way of seeing how large N or large C field theories reorganize themselves into geometry. The first was these tensor networks with these calculations in 2D CFT where you're essentially forced into constructing 3D geometries. 3D geometries are very special. Three dimensions, gravity has no propagating degrees of freedom. This is related to the fact that everything is fixed in the CFT side by Virasoro symmetry. So in the last part, I'm going to go up to D dimensions, where things are harder, but describe a direct relationship between fluctuations in geometry and fluctuations in entanglement entropy. So the motivation goes back to work of Jacobson 20 years ago. What Jacobson did is to apply thermodynamics to local Rindler horizons. So the first law of thermodynamics says that TdS equals TE. If you take a curved space and you zoom in on any point, you can think of it as the bifurcation point of a local Rindler horizon, this point here. If you send energy through your local Rindler horizon and measure the response of the geometry, so you measure the change in area as you send in this energy, then if you impose the first law on those fluctuations at every point in space-time, this implies the Einstein equation. So you can think of the Einstein equation in this thermodynamic way. Suggest the Einstein equations are some kind of thermodynamics. I say some kind of thermodynamics because in this local Rindler picture, it's not really clear what the microscopic definition of everything is. This S is just declared to be equal to the area. I don't know how it's defined or what it's counting or how to define it, how to say what it is microscopically. So there's some connection here between the Einstein equations and thermodynamics, but exactly what we mean by all these quantities is not clear at all. So the aim of this work, which I should say is based on this paper with Tom Faulkner, Monica Glica, Bob Myers, and Mark von Ramsdunk, which followed these other two papers. So the goal was to try to transplant this picture of Jacobson into ADS-CFT, where we know microscopic definitions of everything. And this is only going to be partly successful, and I'll explain why. So if geometry is coming from entanglement, then the Einstein equations should somehow be thought of as governing the fluctuations of entanglement. So a starting point here is to ask what fluctuations of entanglement look like. The answer looks something like a first law. So in any state, we can define what's called the modular Hamiltonian in this way. So in state rho, we can define the operator H. Rho is positive, so we can write it in this way and use it to define the modular Hamiltonian H. H is an operator that depends on the state. It depends on the state in this way. It's a perfectly well-defined mapping from states to operators, but we have to be a little careful when we compute expectation values and so on because HA depends on the state. So varying both sides of this equation gives what we might call the first law, delta S equals delta expectation value of H. So I'm going to call this the first law of entanglement entropy, but as you can tell from the way I've described it, this is completely vacuous. This is a tautology. All I did was write the two sides in terms of different variables and vary it. However, in certain contexts, this modular Hamiltonian is a conserved charge. In certain contexts, H has some other definition. We can compute it some other way. And in that case, this is a useful relation. So in that case, this really is something like the first law of thermodynamics. So an example is that if we take our system to be the thermofield double with A and B entangled like a thermofield double, then HA is the ordinary Hamiltonian, and this is the ordinary first law at temperature 1. So there are other cases where HA has a nice interpretation as a conserved charge. One example is for a plane, a half plane, in a Lorentz invariant field theory. In this case, if we take region A, so this is space, we take region A to be half of space, then the modular Hamiltonian for the ground state is the boost charge, is the conserved charge associated to boosts that keep you inside this wedge.
So any Euclidean space, that would just be rotation.
That's right. So that's true in any Lorentz invariant theory. In a conformal field theory, a half space can be mapped to a ball. So we get something even better, which is that we can calculate the modular Hamiltonian for a ball-shaped region. So if we take region A to be, so this plane is a fixed time slice. This is space. Here's our region A. The causal development of region A is in this cone. In a conformal field theory, the generator of translations inside this cone is a symmetry. So this isn't true in general, but in conformal field theory, this is a symmetry. It's a combination of translations and special conformal transformations. So it has some conserved charge, and the modular Hamiltonian is the conserved charge for this symmetry. So if we consider perturbations above the ground state in the conformal field theory, then we can write a first law of entanglement entropy for any ball-shaped region. So delta S equals delta H. For any ball, this means a ball centered at x naught with radius r. So there are an infinite number of different first laws that we can write down for conformal field theory perturbed above the vacuum state. And as I said, because H has this definition as a charge, this is actually a meaningful equation. So far, this is just a general discussion about conformal field theories. Now, consider a holographic CFT. The claim is that in the holographic CFT, this infinite set of relations is the linearized Einstein equation. It can't literally be the linearized Einstein equation because it doesn't depend on the right variables. But essentially, this is an integral transform of the Einstein equation. So this is an infinite number of equations labeled by a size and a center. And the Einstein equation is an infinite number of equations labeled by a point in the bulk. But these are an integral transform of each other. So this is true for the Einstein equations, and there's a similar statement in arbitrary higher derivative theory of gravity. The way this works, first I want to draw the Ruta-Kanagi surface for this situation. So the way this works is that a ball-shaped region in the CFT is related to an ADS Rindler patch. Okay, so this picture makes much sense. So the plane here is the boundary CFT. B is the region that we're interested in. It's a ball-shaped region. And the Ruta-Kanagi surface corresponding to this region is the semicircle that heads out into the bulk, which is the bifurcation surface of a Rindler horizon ending on the boundary. Does that picture sort of make sense? Okay, so this region on the boundary has a causal diamond, and that causal diamond goes out into the bulk, into this ADS Rindler patch. So the statement of the first law is that fluctuations in the entanglement entropy for these ball-shaped regions are fluctuations in the area of an ADS Rindler horizon. Or in a higher derivative theory, fluctuations in some generalization of the area given by the Wald formula. So on the gravity side, we had this infinite number of first laws, one for each ball. On the gravity side, this is an equation for linearized perturbations above the vacuum. On the left-hand side, the change in entropy is some fluctuation in the area or entropy density, entropy of the Ruta-Kanagi surface or the ADS Rindler horizon. So this is some integral of some local density over the Ruta-Kanagi surface. On the right-hand side, we have the change in a conserved charge. So conserved charges in gravity are boundary integrals. So there's translating into gravity variables. This gives you some integral over the boundary of some something that depends on your perturbation. So S is the entropy density, T is the modular energy density. And every ball, we get one of these integral equations. This set of integral equations, one for every ball, can be transformed to a local differential equation for the perturbation. And that local differential equation for the perturbation is the Einstein equation. So I'm not gonna write equations down. I'll just tell you why you might expect something like this to make sense and to work. Yeah.
Which variations do we allow? More precisely, if you change the shape of the surface slightly, then you would have to change also the modular of Hamiltonian in a non-local fashion. It would not be a conserved charge anymore. So when you write delta H, what exactly do you mean?
Delta of H, so this goes back to the fact that H is labeled by state.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
That's
so
what you're asking.
I would expect another term which looks like bracket delta H inside.
The definition of the right-hand side is that we vary the state, not the operator.
We vary the state, but not the operator. But what if you change the shape of the surface? That would force you to change the modular Hamiltonian. It's not a change in the state.
The definition of the first law is that, so there's a... the definition of this variation is trace of delta rho, H of rho. Doesn't change the variation that appears in the first law doesn't change the modular Hamiltonian. And this will happen at higher orders, but.
So you interpret a small change in the shape of the surface as a change in the density matrix, not as a change in the Hamiltonian.
That's right.
Why? A change in the density matrix is an excitation with a fixed geometry. So if you insert some states in a fixed geometry, you change the density matrix.
So
if you change the geometry, you change the modular Hamiltonian.
At first order, it's all excitations at first order. So at first order, the surface doesn't even change. It's an extremal surface. So the area of the surface changes, but the surface does not.
Oh, so you keep the shape fixed. It's always a ball.
It's always a ball.
Also, yeah. This variation is also in the geometric interpretation. Of whatever you're going to explain now, they do not include fluctuations of the shape of the surface, of the boundary of the shape of the surface.
That's right.
It's always a bound.
We're taking a fixed region, and we're just changing the state.
Okay, that's okay. No problem.
Okay. Okay, so I won't go through the derivation from here, the Einstein equations, but just to give some intuition for how you might expect to get local data out of these integral equations. Well, we have these, we want some information about the perturbation at this point. We don't have information about points, we have all these integral equations. But if you start drawing all the different horizons that can go through that point, there are an infinite number of them, and you can imagine that repackaging this information somehow, the set of all possible horizons through a point actually gives you local data about that point. So that's essentially what we did. There's an integral, there's a transform of this equation that turns it into a local differential equation.
And this can be sub-ADS size.
Yes. This is all, yeah. So let me make a few comments about the comparison to this Jacobson philosophy. So Jacobson's first law was for local Rindler horizons. The output is the full nonlinear Einstein equations, but the microscopic definitions of things were not so clear. Using this entanglement entropy point of view in ADS, we have to use global Rindler horizons. We have no idea what the microscopic dual of the entropy of a local Rindler horizon means. Even in ADS. So we're stuck with global Rindler horizons. what's nice is that all the things involved do have a precise microscopic definition. But because we need global Grinler horizons, that means we need symmetries on the background, and that means we can only get the linearized field equations, linearized about the vacuum. The obstacle here is that this thing that I called the first law really requires your modular Hamiltonian to be a conserved charge to have any useful content. So apparently, this sort of relation, as far as we know, is useless on excited states. So I'll end with a recap and some open questions. So I described three hints for some important relationship between entanglement, entropy, and geometry. The first was this tensor network business and the Grutak-Inagi formula, the relation between geometry and entanglement. Of course, the big question here is what quantitative tools we can glean from this. The second thing was large C calculations in 2D conformal field theory, the fact that these automatically sort of produce 3D geometries when you try to do these calculations. The question here is how far we can push the 1 over C expansion. A 1 over C expansion, if you could really do it systematically, would be a derivation of perturbative, or a derivation of ADS CFT to some extent. So it's worth exploring corrections in 1 over C and other types of states and so on. The third thing was this first law of entanglement entropy that allows us to reconstruct at least the linearized bulk geometry around the vacuum. As I said, the big question there was whether we can say anything about the nonlinear geometry in more than two dimensions. All right, thanks.
So we're talking about whether or not you can do this non-linearly. I mean, if you're in pure gravity, the only solutions are quotients of ADS, like BTZ black holes, where it seems like the argument must go through by some...
So in three dimensions, we can definitely say non-linear. These were higher genus things, and these were non-linear statements. But in higher dimensions...
Higher dimensions is hard, sure.
It's hard. Yeah, when I said nonlinear, I was really talking about more than three bulk dimensions.
Well, I mean, even three bulk dimensions with non-gravitational excitation—that's
true.
It's hard. I was just saying, right. There's in some case that's really easy. It's just BTZ black holes.
Right.
Should we talk about the second law of fundamentals, like Strauss relativity?
Yeah.
So, but what does it mean for?
So there's definitely a nice geometric interpretation of strong subadditivity as a statement at fixed time, or even in a time-dependent situation. I suspect we'll hear about that from Matt Hedrick next week, but I probably don't want to get into it now. What it says about fluctuations, I don't know if that's really been studied.
At what point do you bring in higher derivative gravity? You said your program worked in linearized normal higher derivative gravity.
Yeah, so everything that I said in part three about the derivation of the field equations can be generalized to higher derivative. So the way it works is that instead of starting, so at this step, where you translate this CFT equation into a gravity equation, you have to pick an entropy density. And if you pick entropy equals area, you're going to end up with the Einstein equations. But if you pick a more general entropy density, you're going to end up with higher curvature equations, exactly corresponding to the entropy density that you picked.
I mean, what freedom is there in picking S1?
So we'll get something. So there's a Wald formula for the entropy density in higher derivative theory, and as long as we pick the entropy functional to be something that could come out of the Wald formula, then we'll end up with the corresponding higher derivative equations of motion.
Okay, but you're looking at just a linearized equation. How would that be a higher derivative? Right?
Well, it's
to all the reducing derivatives, presumably, but just to first order in the metric fluctuation.
So it's basically the same as doing R squared. The R squared stuff matters because you're on ADS. Higher terms don't make much difference. They just, at linearized order, everything is R squared gravity.
More questions or comments?